Alrighty, so first thing, please tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you were doing there.
So my name is Silke Stutzinski, and I started working at the ECCC in early 2008. I was the first international civil party lawyer, and I was working in the context of a program of a German development organization, which was called Justice and Reconciliation around the Khmer Rouge Tribunal.
All right. So this was the first international court to use civil party representation. Keeping that in mind, can you tell us about some of the challenges in your work, both with civil party attorneys, but also thoughts about the court in general?
Look, upon when I arrived in February 2008, there was, I found nothing for civil parties. That started with office space or with getting stationery or being included into any forms or whatsoever. So it was completely unknown. Unknown in practice, I mean. The first internal rules were already adopted at that time, but what I'm saying now is about the practice then on my arrival. And the victims unit didn't exist back then, so there were also no forms for victims to apply and no instructions for them how to do that. Of course, this developed over time, but so that was really at my arrival then also being discussed as in the first pretrial hearing when it was about pretrial detention, and then the first landmark decision was issued by the pretrial chamber, a ruling on the standing of civil parties in pretrial hearings and in especially here in detention hearings. Because the defense asked, what are you doing here? These hearings are not supposed to have the attendance of civil parties. And so then they objected against the presence, and but the pretrial chamber even looked for other opinions and amici curiae, and then to rule finally, yes, civil party and their lawyers have a standing during these type of pretrial hearings.
All right. So since there were, you know, some challenges in the beginning, you had mentioned in an article a few years back about how cases 1 and 2 had some issues with civil party participation, particularly for the process and the criteria for being admitted as civil parties to the court, and that a pretty significant percentage of those were rejected in those two cases. So tell us a little bit about this and how the admissibility issues impacted the experience of the civil parties at the ECCC, and maybe how the ECCC learned from the mistake.
Yeah, the procedure was for the civil parties at least not clear at all. There were different, if I look back, different procedures applied in case 001 and in case 002 later. And this was with regard who decides when, and what status is granted at the beginning. So, for example, in case 001, not all applications were decided by the co-investigating judges, but they shifted and handed over the civil party applications to the trial chamber, who then ruled on some of them that they have interim status or they have status or they were rejected. And so it was pretty much unclear what this means for them. And then at the end of the trial, there was a big surprise for civil parties when many of them were rejected in the trial judgment only, without even knowing, naming the persons, but of course, since those who were admitted at the end and their participation confirmed were named, that means it was not a very high number of civil parties. So everybody knew, of course, who was not admitted and rejected. And this turned out, if you ask me about the impact for civil parties, that was enormous, a very terrible experience for them. We had on the same day a meeting with all civil parties and also people from TPO, from a psychologist attending, and they were crying, all of them. So those who were admitted, also because in solidarity with their other civil parties with whom they participated already now for several months in trial and had meetings together and so on and so on. So they were completely shocked and disappointed. And okay, we appealed, I think, in the different groups for their respective clients, and more were then admitted by the Supreme Court chamber. But why did this happen? Because there were no clear instructions from the trial chamber what they are doing, and that was continued finally also in case 002. The procedure was changed, the rules were amended, and now it was clear OCIJ, that means co-investigating judges, had to decide with the closing order, with the indictment, on all civil party applications. Okay, they did this, but without telling what the criteria are, because the rules changed also from case one to case two, where in case one, it was still all those are admissible who fall or can establish that they are victim of a crime under the jurisdiction of the court. While in case two, a jurisdiction that is broader, that is the entire time from 75 to 79, and not linked to the indictment. Then the rules were changed, and during the application process already. So they applied already, and then it was changed, and they learned only if they can establish a link to one of the crimes in the indictment, or of the charges, and later than the indictment. And then the civil parties did not know what the scope of the investigations are or is. And that means they did not know which security centers, for example, or which work sites or which other crimes were included. Only then, just shortly before the deadline for the applications was, they issued a press release, and in this press release briefly described the areas. Also, this press release left it open how to understand certain investigations. For example, religious persecution, is it only against monks, or is it against the entire population of Buddhist believers? And that means the great majority of Cambodians. And so it was and remained unclear for them even after this press release was issued. This was not the only thing. Then OCIJ rejected, I would say, around 50% or 48% of all applicants in case one, case two, sorry. And that means 50%, yeah? So that meant then the procedure also for appealing these decisions was amended. So the deadline was shortened to 10 days. Then in addition, different practices about counting of deadlines were applied by OCIJ and by the pretrial chamber. So whether it counts already the first day or the day after notification, which is quite relevant if one receives decision at 5:30 p.m., so where day was already gone of the deadline, or whether the deadline starts the next day. So, and all this was also complicating then the appeal process, but finally, to get then back to them and add additional information, so which was possible. So there were several months where we could get in contact with our clients and submit supplementary information. But however, so since it was unclear what exactly is the scope, what exactly falls under would be would establish a link also with regard to what is sufficient as proof was completely unclear. Okay, then all these decisions, 94 decisions were appealed by all civil party lawyers, because they were issued by province summarized. So one had first to look, where are my clients? Are my clients concerned or not? So the appeals were done, and 8 or 9 months later, the pretrial chamber decided. And then they decided there is a general victimhood here, and we admit all of them. Only very few were rejected, but for other issues, like they did not provide a proper ID card or could not show their identity or other things, but or applied after the deadline, but the nearly all were then admitted. Yeah, and if we would have known that this is the understanding and there's no link needs to be established, link between the suffering and a crime in the indictment, that means if we would have known this, that this would be now the new approach of the pretrial chamber, of course, we could have saved a lot of resources, energy to describe in detail, get all the supplementary information from civil parties. It was for all, and of course also the rejections for them were really had a significant impact on them, so that they are rejected, that was when they already acted in practice as civil parties. So they went to civil party meetings, they participated, got information from their lawyers, and also followed the proceedings, what happened. So they felt, they participated in pretrial hearings, other detention hearings that were held over time before trial then started. But so they felt, and also their, let's say, recognition in their villages, for example, then, oh, I'm a civil party, they were proud. So they felt to be, and then rejection. Okay, finally, nearly all were admitted, but after what process, yeah? And keep in mind that there was no legal aid for civil party lawyers, yeah?
Yeah.
So some lawyers were paid by their NGOs or got funding, but it was all outside funding, yeah? So that is also something that you find throughout the entire proceedings, and how can a lawyer work full-time and more than full-time without being properly paid?
Yes, that all sounds incredibly frustrating. So maybe thinking about future courts, since this is the first time that civil parties have been included in an international tribunal, do you think just having clearer rules up front probably would have solved most of those problems, or do you think that there's more that would need to be done?
I think one is clear roles, but is necessary, and clear rules. So the rules were so many times amended, and many times with regard to civil parties and civil parties standing. Yeah. And I did not count, but it was a feeling that 80% of all amendments are in regard to civil parties and curtailing step by step their rights. That means if the entire process would have been thought through at the beginning, right at the beginning, and then have a clear feature, how should it look like, and then okay, that's what we thought through, and that is what applies now. Yeah. Also for civil parties, of course, learning, having never anything to do with the court, let alone this court. So that is very new for many of them, new what to have a standing in a criminal court. And then not knowing, and we couldn't tell them clearly, this is now that is that stands. But it's also consistency. And then, for example, put something in case one, it was at the end, and the decision was only reasoned after the hearings, that civil parties were out of the blue, I must say, excluded from questioning of character witnesses or the psychologist or experts that talked about the mental health of the accused. Of course, this would be very important for civil parties also to have the right to question. And they did this all over trial. They questioned and had the right to question every witness, or be it an expert or fact witness or any other civil parties or the accused. Huh? Of course, the accused has the right to remain silent, but they could do this, which was also a great thing, that even direct questions were allowed to put to the accused. And in case one, as you know, he talked and he responded to these questions. So this was also very great experience for the civil parties to ask. And of course, we prepared these questions in advance. What would you like to know? And then looking what, so that they are prepared and can really address the accused. So, but this was all great. But in total, when I look back, how spontaneous, I must say, the reaction were on, okay, this doesn't work, or we find here we must be more specific, or whatever the change was, but there were so many changes, and always, let's say, curtailing more and more the rights.
Got it. Yeah, I can see how that would be very frustrating as well. So let's talk about reparations for a minute. So the internal rules allowed for collective and moral reparations, but again, not super well defined. So tell us about the civil parties' experience with reparations, what they thought of what was actually implemented, and how that affected their experience at the ECCC.
Yeah, I would like to focus on several aspects of this reparation system. And of course, also this has changed a little bit, and from case one to case two. Mm-hmm. If we look at case one, first, informing the civil parties about their right to reparation, as it was phrased in the internal rules, was not easy, because nobody knew what does it mean. Yeah, moral and collective reparations. And there were some experience from the Inter-American Court, but this is another type of court where states have to compensate victims. This is completely different from, or quite different from, a criminal court. So that means clarity again. What can they expect? What falls under collective? Then the civil parties often said, we don't want any collective reparations. We had under the Khmer Rouge, we had to live as a collective, so we are done with that. We want individual, for only for us, reparations. Mm-hmm. Another aspect was that then the trial chamber ruled that the accused is indigent. That means we don't issue a judgment against the accused. And of course, I would agree that at least in case number one, that this accused, I assume that he was indigent, that that was correct. So, and the trial chamber ruled that they would not issue a reparation order against the accused because he was indigent, or he is indigent, which is at the same time, and it was interesting because at the same time then the Lubanga case came up at the ICC, and where the chamber clearly said, of course, the reparation order must be issued against the person who is convicted, regardless whether this person has now assets or perhaps never assets, but this is, of course, the normal going of a court. Only to give you a brief example, if you would file a lawsuit against somebody who owes you money, then the judge would say, oh, the person is indigent and has no money, so therefore we don't rule against this person, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you can execute this is another question, but to take it away from the burden away from his shoulders, that was, I think, another interesting surprise to hear from this court. And then perhaps one other remark, in case two, the reparation scheme changed and it was more possible to get reparation paid by outside parties who were, for example, embassies or any other foundations and so on, which also is perhaps in some cases, okay, good for the civil parties to get something, but on the other hand, it's also strange why then completely outside parties pay for something which is called reparation, which should of course always be between the convicted person and or the state then standing and stepping in for the convicted person if the convicted person has no means. This is another thing. And one last thing that in case one, this one reparation that was issued, the collection of all the apologies of the accused during trial and or during the investigations, that was a harmful reparation for victims, for the civil parties. They didn't want this because they didn't believe his apologies. And then getting this as a collection, and of course we expressed this, but not listening to the civil parties about their feelings towards these apologies that they did not find sincere. That was also another aspect that consultations or listening to civil parties was not properly done when reparations were issued.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's switch gears just a little. And the ECCC has also been criticized for perhaps not giving enough attention to some of the sexual crimes that were committed during the Khmer Rouge. Now that's something, unlike civil parties, that has been dealt with in international courts before, both at the International Criminal Court and at other ad hoc tribunals like the ECCC. So why do you think there was a delay in giving attention to these types of crimes? And how do you think that they should have been addressed?
Yeah, that is a long story, of course. It is unfortunately often missing, and for a variety of reasons, that the prosecutor who starts investigating a case, be it the case in Cambodia or in any other court, must have from the beginning on a strategy to address sexual crimes, sexualized violence. Mm-hmm. And this has many reasons, because there is the assumption that it's difficult to investigate these type of crimes, that there's stigma related, that they are difficult to prove, that they are not visible as, for example, killings and so on. And then over time, even if there is the assumption at the beginning, okay, we want to investigate these crimes and we look for them, if this strategy is not tested over the time, then they are neglected and finally often do not end in a conviction. So that means these crimes are, let's say, the most neglected crimes if it comes to international or internationalized courts to get them really on the forefront. And yeah, this is now combined in addition with the narrative there that existed back then in for the Cambodian case, that was that the assumption was widespread that the Khmer Rouge were cruel but puritanic, and that no sexual violence was committed. That is an assumption, of course. If one goes with this assumption into a case and believes this, then of course, if one doesn't question and ask questions to witnesses or victims, then you don't get answers. So this is, let's say, around all this, only to touch upon some reasons, but there are, of course, quite more than that.
Sure. So kind of going along those lines a bit more, you were actually involved in the ECCC's recognition of forced marriage as one of the crimes being committed during Khmer Rouge. Can you talk about some of the challenges in having forced marriage recognized as a crime by the ECCC, and how that process affected the civil party participation?
Yeah, as you might know, the fact of forced marriage, or that this could be considered a crime, what was described by scholars and many researchers, these collective marriages, and that was absent from the perception, that these facts, and they were properly described, could be a crime. However, this crime is finally qualified because it doesn't exist in no statute as a specific crime. Forced marriage is then considered to be either rape or sexual enslavement or torture or forced pregnancy or any other crime, which then comes under other inhuman act and also as such as forced marriage. So that means the statute and the legal framework in Cambodia, but also in other courts, does not have forced marriage as a specific crime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is on the legal arena, the point that should be mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I arrived and got in contact with the first persons who told me about these marriages, and then, because I had read about it and was wondering, why does nobody find this is a crime? And system, how it was applied in Cambodia. And then people were asking me, and it continued until now, in when the defense in case two, when finally forced marriage came into a trial, that they questioned, look, in Cambodia you have arranged marriages, and why do you now think this should be a separate crime if you don't see that this crime is as arranged marriage is committed every day in Cambodia and is a tradition. Mm-hmm. And all these questions show that there is a lack of understanding, and that starts with those who start the investigations and goes then further in Cambodia to the co-investigating judges. A lack of understanding how this crime was applied or was committed in Cambodia, and also a lack of investigation skills. Mm-hmm. I remember that for a long time there was even no female investigator. Not that I would say that is already as such a quality, but also trained on these crimes, trained investigator. So all this contributes, of course, for the legal approach. What do we want to investigate? What is crime? And also how to conduct then the investigations. And yeah. It was also for the civil parties, so for the victims of this crime, a long way to recognize for themselves that a crime was committed against them, that this was not normal to force them to consume the marriage and have sexual intercourse, and then for the women to become pregnant, that this is not normal, that this was ordered. And they learned, of course, over time, but at the beginning, this was not recognized or acknowledged, not in society and not in the legal sections in the court.
Gotcha. That's interesting. Lots of good things to think about there. So this may or may not lead into my next question, which is keeping in mind what has been released to the public. Can you recall any accused or survivor stories that particularly resonated with you?
Look, there were really so many, and I heard so many stories that I can't say which is the most resonating. But sure. Maybe one was of one of my clients who only first to participate, she told the story that she was standing around a pit and with 29 other women, and they were all hit from behind and thrown into the pit, and she was the last one. And then she finally was lucky and she survived and could then later crawl, and they thought she is dead as well, and she crawled out of the pit. And then she also had later a forced marriage. And when we re-interviewed her about the forced marriage, then she started, because then she felt in this situation comfortable, she started to say, this was not all. It was not only that these women were killed, but before they were killed, all of them, including me, we were raped. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And that was... And of course, she was before never asked about it, and or did not feel comfortable when she talked about it. But so this was also, shocking on one hand that this came very late. But of course, what a burden on the feeling of this woman. So this was one which I clearly remember, but. Through what horrors she went, and of course all the other victims as well.
Sure. Okay, so thinking forward a bit, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be for Cambodian society, both today and perhaps 20 years from now?
Look, I think the existence of this court really changed a lot in Cambodia. And this was a history, a part of history, which people did not mention at all. People didn't talk. Parents didn't talk to their children. It was completely, the society was silent. And that was a major effect, that people started learning, started asking questions, started to discuss things. And especially in case one, it was really amazing that when I saw in the market people in their stalls with their small TVs and then watching the hearings, and especially when the civil parties were talking. And so there was a huge participation from people, normal people who, as I said, are selling things at the market. And so there was a huge interest also to learn about what happened. And I think that is a major, major success. And of course, all what was implemented, and I don't want to go further into this, to have now curriculas and so on to get this into school curriculas to train teachers and so on, who also didn't really know. No, this is really, yeah, a big success, because it's necessary that people and the society deals with the past and its own past.
Sure. All right. Well, that's all the questions we have for you, but is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important or you'd like to say?
No, I think perhaps one thing also about the court, or the impact of the court.
Yeah.
Because that was how and why civil party participation is so important, because this gave our civil parties a standing, and it was so important for them to learn that they have something to say in a society where they felt to be neglected, poor people, often from villages, and who, yeah, learned that they can say something, that they can stand up, and where they feel that they are treated with respect. And that was very important as personal experience and also for their self-confidence. So I think the entire system of civil party participation contributed a lot, that they have also now, beyond the court, standing in their communities more than they had before they became a civil party. That is what I observed as a very important impact. Of course, it's not the business of court, but this was a side effect which should not be underestimated. And then how much the court triggered other initiatives. Mm-hmm. So NGOs coming, starting dialogues, performing, playing theater, providing psychological assistance and so on. And also, of course, a lot of researchers came then and focused on specific aspects, yeah, which was not the case when I arrived, for example, on sexual violence or forced marriage. There was nearly nothing. The small brochure from about some cases or so from Kasumi, and then that was what existed, yeah. And there, for example, the films that were produced about it, about forced marriage, the film Red Wedding. So all these are products, and many, many more than I can mention, that would not exist without the court, without the existence of the court.
Yeah, that's certainly a good thing for us to think about. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate taking the time to do this.
Okay.